I'm Bill Barol. Over the last few decades, I've done every kind of writing there is to do, from journalism to humor, books, movies, and television.
I'm Matt Ricardo. For the last 30 years, I've toured the world as a variety performer.
Earlier this year, we came together across the Atlantic to talk about creativity, what it is, where it comes from, why it matters.
Thomas Edison said, "To invent, you need a good imagination and a pile of junk."
This is Imagination and Junk, a conversation about the hard work of creativity.
Episode 5, Angry Playtime.
Dear Matt, I don't spend a lot of time reminiscing about my days as a comedy writer, but I've been thinking about something that happened to me years ago when I was working on a terrible sitcom called Can't Hurry Love. I'd written the script that week, and there was a bit in it for one of the secondary players that he made sure we understood he did not care for. I don't remember what the bit was or why he didn't like it. I just remember that there were nervous phone calls from the director about trouble brewing. And when we went to the stage for the script's first run-through, the actor came steaming up to the showrunners and pulled them aside for one of those monologues that unspools in an escalating sequence of angry whispers. There was a lot of gesticulating. The showrunners did their murmuring best to placate him, while the writers stood awkwardly off to one side, and the other actors did a clumsy pantomime of being absorbed in their scripts. But the guy was clearly not in the mood to be placated, and eventually the bosses nodded and patted him on the back and moved away and, "Hey, let's have a good run-through, everybody." Well, you know enough about performance, more than enough, to know what happened next. In the most drearily predictable way, the guy tanked the bit and it collapsed. There was a terrible dead space in the air where a laugh should have been. Time stopped and folded in on itself. And what happened next was, in the context of the genteel theatrical protocol that usually governs these things, shocking. The actor took his script and, making sure that every eye in the place was on him, he skimmed it violently across the floor, as if it were a flaming frisbee. Authorship of sitcom scripts is functionally a group thing, but there's always one writer or a couple who are credited as the authors of record. When things go well, those writers collect the high fives. And when they don't, well, those writers, more than the others, feel the whole weight of that failure, as I did that day. I was furious at the disrespect the guy had shown the script, and by extension, me, and by his lack of professionalism. Now, what you want to do in that moment is keep your cool. I did not keep my cool. I felt my face get hot and my heart hammer in my chest, and something in the evolved part of my brain told me that I needed to remove myself from the immediate area before I acted as badly as he had. So I jumped to my feet and stomped away toward the far end of the stage, and I was, at that point, basically done for the day. How you doing today? A little cranky, maybe? Not sure you're in the best frame of mind to be creative? One of the threads we've pulled in this podcast is that there is no ideal time to be creative, and if creativity is your profession, you don't have the luxury of waiting for the right mood to strike. Still, if you ask me, I'd probably say that there are some emotional conditions under which it's less easy, maybe even less advisable, to do creative work, and that being angry would probably top that list. But that may be exactly wrong. A decade ago, a group of Dutch researchers published a series of studies about the relationship between anger and creativity. Their counterintuitive thesis was that anger makes you more distractible, which in turn inhibits structured thinking. The angry person hops around from one thought category to another, which shakes up the brain, unlocks unusual intuitive leaps, and leads to a phenomenon called divergent thinking, what civilians, especially ones prone to cliché, call thinking outside the box. The caveat the researchers offer is that the beneficial brain effects of anger, as opposed to sadness, and yes, they deliberately made their test subjects both angry and sad, which must have made for some fun times in the lab, those beneficial effects don't have a very long shelf life. But while they were clicking, the angry subjects were clicking, doing thinking that was both more original and more productive than subjects who were feeling sad or neutral. The intriguing scenario this suggests is that if I'd simply headed back to the writer's room and jumped into the process of finding a fix, I might have been unusually well suited to the task. I didn't do that. There was a certain amount of bitching about actors that had to be done, both this guy individually and actors as a class. And then, of course, we had to figure out where we were going to have dinner sent in from. So whatever useful brain reordering might have been available to me, it had probably dissipated by the time we opened up our scripts. It's interesting, though, don't you think? My instinct, if I'm having an angry day, is to walk away from work like I walked away from that actor. To get outside, take a walk, cool off. I'm wondering how it is with you. Where does negative energy fit in your process? This is traditionally where I'd close by wishing you a pleasant day there by the waters of the English coast, but now, I don't know. Maybe I should be deliberately trying to enrage you. Let me know if that works for you, and I'll cook up some insults. Take care, stay well, and piss off, I guess? Bill.
Dear Bill, up your butt with a coconut and in your ear with a can of beer. To quote the great Daphne DiConcerto and Celeste Cruz in a reference that, frankly, if anyone gets, they are now my best friend forever. Here's my feelings on those Dutch researchers who said that people who get angry feedback work better. Screw 'em. I do not buy it. It feels to me like exactly the kind of research cited by crappy bosses to justify a toxic and bullying work environment. All stick, no carrot. I just don't buy it. Here's the thing about anger and other kinds of negative emotions. They come easy. I mean, they certainly come easy to me, but I think they come easy to most people. Certainly they come easier than those other, perhaps healthier motivating forces, self-belief and confidence. And they do motivate, but do they motivate the same thing in the same way? I think anger focuses you. That's literally its job, to see a threat, a rival or a heavily armed bear or something, and to prepare your body and mind for either getting the hell out of there or diving in fists swinging. But how does that work in terms of creativity? Maybe it still focuses you to somehow want to beat something or someone, which isn't, or at least shouldn't be, your goal as a maker. Those Dutch researchers said, being yelled at creates what they call divergent thinking. I'd call it panic. And it's not usually the state of mind that creates the most interesting work. In my experience, creative work is best done in something that feels, at least to some degree, like isolation. If I'm constantly aware of what other people who make things similar to me are doing, then there's no way I'll still be able to make my best work. Same thing if someone is yelling at me to do better or faster. It all starts to feel like a fight, and when something feels like a fight, then you can't avoid defining yourself as either a winner or a loser. But I'm not saying that anger isn't useful. More than once, someone has annoyed me enough to become the sand in my clamshell that makes a pearl, as a friend of mine used to say. I totally believe that anger can have a positive effect on you. The way it makes you want to seize the moment and do something, well, that's an effective way to be reminded of your independence and autonomy. And once the bad feeling has faded, you can look back at yourself and consider why you were angry and if really you should have been. And that might lead to growth, and growth is good. I heard a fighter say this the other day, and it seems on the money. He said, "Get angry while you train. Use that power to work harder and longer. But once you're in the fight, across from your opponent, be calm, happy even, because anger blinkers you and stiffens your movements. If you're happy and relaxed, you're fluid and you'll see everything." It feels like anger might be a good motivator for something simple like exercise. Screw it, I'm doing an extra couple of miles in my run today just out of spite. But making things feels a bit more fragile, like it wouldn't benefit from the nitrous button that negative emotions can provide. But during those extra couple of miles of running, I bet there's a decent chance that some nice creative thoughts will start swimming around in your head. As I write this, though, I have remembered something that I do well while angry. Admin. Office work. For some reason, grit teeth, bald fists, and a deep-seated feeling of the world having treated me unfairly is a terrific way to get me to send those invoices or chase up that gig lead. I guess it doesn't require much of my soul to do those things, just the blunt force energy that grumpiness can provide in spades. I hope you don't have spadefuls of grumpy blunt force energy. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, yeah, I know. I lobbed up that Dutch research in the hope that it would strike you as, well, something other than flatly ridiculous. I mean, I was willing to be convinced. But you're right, it just doesn't pass the smell test. It feels like a fundamental misapprehension of what creativity is. After all, you know what absolutely nobody says. If you want to understand a Picasso, talk to a neurologist. I can only think of one scenario in which unpleasant emotions make me anything like creative. It's the one in which, when I'm confronted with some bad behavior on somebody's part, and yes, you're right, it always does seem to be somebody rather than something, I sit at my keyboard and dash off, in a white heat, an angry rocket of an email. I can rise to some rhetorical heights in this situation. What I'm saying is, and I don't want to brag, when it comes to self-righteous indignation, I've got some game. The only problem is, when I get swept away by the majesty of my own fury, I tend to lose sight of the fact that there's really only one correct thing to do with an email like this, and that is not send it. The reason I know this is that I've never pushed send on one of these things without immediately, and I mean in a nanosecond, being consumed with a conviction that, like Joe Bluth in Arrested Development, I've made a huge mistake. And it is. It's always a huge mistake. Not because you lose the moral high ground, although you do, but because it just doesn't work. That is, it doesn't do what you want it to do, which is induce an instant and total character transformation in the recipient. All it does, however eloquent it may be, is make you look hysterical, which in that moment you are. You're silly. You've set yourself a task at which you can't possibly succeed, and you've thrown yourself into it with everything you have. This is precisely why the Dutch guys are all wet when it comes to creativity. Yes, anger may focus you, but you're right to ask, focus you on what? That's a key question. I can only answer for myself, but for me, anger, wounded pride, indignation, what unpleasant emotions do is focus me on me, my hurt, my embarrassment, my loss of status, the disrespect that's been shown individually and personally to me. This is exactly the opposite of the expansive stance I want to have when I sit down to make something. Creativity is a way of encompassing the world, all of it, as you understand it, and forging something out of that understanding that wasn't there before. It isn't me against the world. It's me in the world. And that difference is everything. When you said that the Dutch study sounded to you like the kind of dubious research that would be used by a toxic boss to rationalize a lousy work environment, I thought, oh, that's interesting, in the detached way of somebody who's been lucky enough to never work for a toxic boss in a lousy environment. But I have had some indirect experience of them, and that notion of competition, of winners and losers, who's up and who's down, it always seems to be there in those bad workplaces, doesn't it? Thrumming away under the surface to keep everybody off balance. This is, among the many other things that are wrong with it, a lousy setting in which to do creative work, because creativity is not a competition. I'm not arguing here for Olympian detachment, or the notion that creative people are Fabergé eggs who are just too beautiful and fragile for this world and need to be protected from it. But I do think that creativity requires a degree of self-sufficiency, and that's hard to pull off if you're constantly measuring yourself up against other people who do what you do, because envy clouds your judgment, and it makes honest creative choices difficult. One of the reasons I love the story you told about the fighter is because fighters make excellent exemplars of creativity. They face each other alone, act and react in the moment, and write a story whose outcome can't be predicted with any degree of certainty. If that isn't creative, I don't know what is. By the way, I'm wondering if you, in your struggling years, ever had to put in any time in a toxic day job, and if it raised any negative emotions for you. And if it did they leach into your creative life? Before we leave them, a couple of other things about our Dutch friends' research. They noted that, and I'm quoting here from a 2011 article in Psychology Today, some reputable scientists and artists were angry people, and some great scientific discoveries have stemmed from intense rivalries between competing laboratories with their academic directors driven by distrust, anger, and frustration. What's that? Some artists are angry, you say? And academic research can be a snake pit? Mercy! I'm also wondering about the controls on their experiment. If they had subjects who were what they called mood neutral, ones who were angry and ones who were sad, wouldn't it have been reasonable to have a fourth group who were both angry and sad? And how did that work, exactly? I mean, did they slap this group around and call them stupid and then immediately remind them that they were also never again going to experience young love? And how did they calibrate it? He's tipping into the red, Professor. Quickly, administer more Joni Mitchell. I need 100 cc's of the last time I saw Richard. Stat! I hope your emotional clockworks are ticking along in an orderly fashion. I'll talk to you soon. Bill.
Dear Bill, not only have I never had a toxic boss in a day job, I've never had a day job. But I have worked for toxic people for sure. I am in show business after all. Many, many years ago, I spent a year or so touring as the sidekick to another variety act. It was his show, but I was the only other cast member. We devised the show together, and I was on stage almost as much as him, but he always made sure that I was very aware of my place. Those tours were full of the kind of microaggressions that seem hilarious decades later. I remember once we were driving the 2 minutes from the hotel to the theatre. The booking agent had come to see the show, and I was made to get out of the car and walk so that the agent could be driven. The agent was as perplexed and uncomfortable as I was. Things got to a head when I asked for a tiny raise in the pittance I was being paid, since we were now working in ever larger venues. I got a flat no. So I told him that I'd do the remaining dates I'd agreed to, but then I would be leaving the show. He immediately sacked me. The next week, though, he called me and tried to pressure me to falsify a doctor's note saying that the reason I wasn't at the dates he'd sacked me from was because I was ill. I take no pleasure from the show fizzling out and shutting down soon after I left. No pleasure at all. He still performs on cruise ships, and he does some of my material there too. A weaker man would dream of giving him, as we say in London, a little spank. But I, of course, have risen above such fantasies of vengeance. I really love what you said about anger forcing your focus to be on you and how that's not conducive to good creativity. I agree. If you're able and willing to see yourself not as the world's protagonist, but instead as just one tiny pixel in its picture, well, then you're making yourself open to so much more raw material to inspire and influence your work. Also, as an added bonus, you'll be less self-absorbed and more of a fully rounded, pleasant human. Having said that, though, it is important to stay true to your creative ideas and not to let the world convince you that they're not as good as you think they might be. You have to make them and then find out. And that's where a different kind of grumpiness might actually be useful. That sweet spot between stoicism and stubbornness, where you're so convinced that an idea is sound or a gag is funny or whatever, that you will pursue it to the bitter end until you're either vindicated or humiliated, but either way, on your terms. I have a line in my theatre show, and I readily admit it's just awful, where I do a trick with a yo-yo, and I introduce it as the favourite toy of the hip-hop community. Get it? Yo-yo. It's awful, but for some reason it tickles me. I like it, so despite the fact that it never really gets much of a laugh, just because of my dogged whim, it stays in the show. And I usually follow it with a comment about how I think it's funny and what the hell do they know, it's not their show, and that usually gets a decent laugh, so I guess I win in the end. So yeah, maybe there's a place for what we're calling negative emotions after the creativity has happened. That kind of grit-teeth determination that helps generate confidence. But in general, good creativity should feel like playtime. And you can't play if you're angry. I hope you're not playing angry. Unless you're a drummer, I guess. Maybe that's the exception. Talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, so I guess we're both in that very rare cohort of people who work in creative industries and haven't had to suffer through bad day jobs. I mean, in our adult working lives. I did spend one summer in college working as a shipping clerk for a marine supply store in Philadelphia, which, if you think about it, is an odd place for a marine supply store, being 2 hours' drive from the ocean, but I wasn't there to critique the business model. I was there to sweat through endless days in an unventilated 19th century brick warehouse, a place that seemed to have been built to keep heat and humidity in, like a baker's oven, and hope and optimism out. My job was to take things off trucks and sometimes, as a madcap change of pace, put things on trucks. Thinking about this today got me in a nostalgic mood for the colorful crew of guys I worked with, including Vince the shipping manager, who maintained an archive of the world's most disturbing pornography in an old upright desk. I suppose for days when his attention wandered beyond the job, which was all of them. Anyway, I checked, and the business is no longer operating. I'm really hoping that this isn't because, in my last week there, when I'd gone insane from the heat like a minor character in Lawrence of Arabia, I accidentally put 6 jet skis on the wrong truck and sent them off to, well, I don't know where. Probably someplace where one very happy truck driver treated himself to a lobster dinner that night. When I finally got my courage up and told Vince what I'd done, he looked at me with watery eyes for about 20 seconds, then shrugged and reached down to open his desk drawer. I really didn't want to know what he was reaching for, so I took that as a sign I was dismissed. 2 weeks later, I went back to college, richer in experience, and also suffering from a nasty heat rash. The point is, and I do have one, people who do what we do in the way that we do it are lucky. I try never to lose sight of that, and it sounds like you do too. It's a privilege to be able to opt for what you define as a different kind of grumpiness, the kind that's employed to promote and protect our work. You call this grumpiness the sweet spot between stoicism and stubbornness. I'd frame it a little differently, as the balance point between humility and arrogance. You do want to be humble about your role as one little pixel in the big picture, but you also want to have confidence in the idea that what you do creatively is worth exposing to other people. These things don't, it has to be said, coexist easily. They fight with each other a little bit. But if you want to get anywhere, you have to give the edge to confidence. But by how much? How much confidence is the correct amount? I'd argue that the correct amount is too much. There's a thin line between self-belief and pushiness, and the way to be an effective advocate for your own ideas is to overstep that line. You can't be shy about it. Here's another analogy from sports. As I'm writing this, Steph Curry of the Warriors is in the midst of an insane run of recklessly beautiful scoring. He's making shots no mortal human has a right to make. If you watch a great shooter like Curry long enough, and it's undeniably creative, his game, the gorgeous, fluid improv of it, if you watch Curry, you notice what he does when he's not making those shots. He keeps taking them. He doesn't take his foot off the gas. He stomps the hammer down. Is that arrogance? Was it arrogance when Kobe Bryant used the boos of out-of-town crowds as fuel to supercharge his game? It might look that way. But keep in mind what another great athlete, Dizzy Dean, once said. It ain't bragging if you can do it. So if in your act you want to insist on a mild little joke that might appeal to nobody but you, and then you have to buy it back with a shrug when nobody laughs, hang on to that joke. Because, to recap, anger may be bad when it comes to making things, but a little arrogance can be useful. And if that seems like a too thin slice of the onion, well, thinly sliced onions are what we're about around here. You can't talk about creativity without considering fine distinctions, and our own emotions, as mysterious as they are, shouldn't be immune from that. They're the legs that propel the jump shot. And you gotta keep shooting. I'll talk to you soon. Bill. Imagination and Junk is written by Bill Barole in the U.S. and Matt Ricardo in the U.K., with audio production by Bill Barole. For more information, show notes, and bonus content, it's imaginationandjunk.com.